I can see all of us are now settled. I have been looking forward to see many other people from other committees since we are actually approaching this meeting as a cluster committee on governance. Of course, it will be governance and monitoring, just to indicate that as Parliament, we haven't reached a stage where the clusters have been formalized, but we are moving towards the approach of a cluster formation. And we're actually doing this because the cluster approach in terms of dealing with oversight is much more appropriate and efficient. So it makes the interaction of various clusters into oversight quite efficient and quite easier, where more than one committee can be able to sit and go through issues that relate in various areas. I want to take you through what you're envisaging as the clusters within, as the committees that fall within the cluster until such time that they're announced by Parliament. But just to indicate that we did start this process as early as last year. We did have a first cluster meeting. This was envisaged to be the second cluster meeting, which will look at it quite broadly after I identify what might have been a weakness in this instance in terms of us moving forward. But we realized in our first cluster meeting that we had how efficient it works, even if when we call the governance and administration cluster from the side of government, how issues interlink, how issues sort of come together and how efficient it does become. And we're going to pursue, particularly ourselves, this committee on public service and administration. We will pursue and spearhead the process, assist Parliament to get the clusters as fast as is possible, because for us, it really works better. Because our work does not relate to a particular cluster, but they cut across. and therefore it is to our interest to have a cluster and also overlap to other clusters in terms of our work of governance. And as we can emphasize that from our current workshop, we have realized that if we pull all the mechanisms that come before Parliament, such as the report on public service commissions, such as Auditor General's report, and then our program is actually highlighting quite critically how much we impact on various other clusters, and we're therefore going to proceed that way. Thank you, Honourable Members. Thank you, the Department of Public Service, Administration. We are today going to focus on a program that is which was supposed to be last meeting, like I indicated. That will be the briefing. It was supposed to be a briefing by the Minister on Public Service and Administration on the Anti-Corruption and Batupili Program of the Department of Public Service and Administration. I know I'm repeating myself. But what I just need to say, we do have some few apologies that are here. We do have also people that are present that I'm going to actually introduce. But it's important for me to indicate that our meeting was supposed to be at 2 o'clock this afternoon. And unfortunately, due to unforeseen circumstances, there was a clash with a cluster meeting that comes up, where governance is part of it again, where we'll be going through the money bill. As you know, there's an introduction of the money bill, something that we've been looking forward as Parliament to actually engage on. Because that workshop is starting at 2 o'clock, we therefore had to shift our time to 10 o'clock. And as we know, it's Wednesday, Cabinet Day. Of course, the Minister committed himself to be part of this meeting for addressing the matters that we put before him. Well, due to the shift, we might not have the Minister. He might join us later, because he'll be starting in the Cabinet task. He might really join us later, and therefore putting this as an apology, which is not because of his liking, but due to this change, which is a little bit inconvincing, is the change that actually also make us from the committee side not to become a cluster as we actually envisage, but moving forward that will be corrected. Because I already met with the chair of chairs this morning, and we have actually worked on that, and we have tried to correct that. So I'm going to put the apologies that are before us from the side of the committee. We've got an apology from the minister, as I've already done it. It's the other apologies from the deputy minister, who is on sick leave. We've got another apology from Honorable Kume, who won't be with us. Honorable Bushiko, they are on oversight together with Honorable Williams. They are actually, because members participate in more than one committee, so the committee is on oversight. Honorable Dreyer, who had a bereavement at home, most of you might have heard on news that he lost his brother, her brother, through that plane crash, which is a sad moment, and we hope that they cope well with the sad news. So Honourable Dreyer won't be with us again due to that. So while I'm welcoming the department, I just want to introduce who is part of us today. We've got Mrs. Clark, who is the Acting Director General. We've got Mrs. Clark, so that people know.
Yes. Tumelo Kopani.
Okay, we've got Tihopani, that's Tumelo, as the acting teacher has already introduced her. We've got Ms. Abrams, yes, and then who is the parliamentary officer. Ms. Kopani is the director in the department, right? Okay. We've got Mr. Govender, who's always part of the department and committee work. And we've got Mr. Mtembo. Acting DG, can you then proceed with the ones that I did not introduce, perhaps, so that everybody knows who's among us?
There would be two other members joining us because of the change in time. Ms. Veronica Matalani would be joining us, as well as Mr. Marcel Wilson. They're on their way. Yeah.
Exactly. Did I cover all of you from the department?
Yeah.
Anyone I know?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Then these are the members that you know them. It's Honorable Bikani, it's Honorable Van Skalkwyk, it's Honorable Suka, it's Honorable Maluleka, and Honorable Mohali. And I am Ms. Mului Morupa. Honorable Murupa. Okay. So, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen, we'll commence with the meeting. Like I've outlined the agenda, with apologies to the members who did not receive the change of time on time. And with the suggestion that was done by Ms. Honorable Van Skalkwyk that we need to also just send the SMSs because the pigeon holes might not be reached quite easily. I want to believe that we capture that from our secretariat side because it really assists. And then it might coordinate our work better and our practice for actually dealing with the changes which were inevitable. Okay. So on our program, we're going to have the presentation number to Billy, and we'll have the presentation on anti-corruption. I can see the anti-corruption presentation is already on the slide, and I will allow the department to proceed if they're ready to do so.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, honourable members, and thank you to everybody present. We have been requested to do a presentation on two aspects. So thank you for your indulgence in starting with the first presentation that has been loaded, although you wanted a particular program first. I'll be focusing on the aspects of the anti-corruption program and giving a background into this particular program and looking at the measures that are in place to fight corruption, which were part of the National Anti-Corruption Strategy, looking at the structures that are in place and also proposed structures to be put in place, as well as looking at the capacity building and the capacity development initiatives that are in place that have been part of the strategy, and also sharing with you the international conventions and compliance instruments that we are party to in terms of addressing the aspect of anti-corruption, and also our understanding from the assessments that have been done of the benefits and the value add of us being party to these international and regional legal instruments that are in place. Just to share with you, to give you a holistic and cogent understanding of the gestalt picture of the anti-corruption framework, the Minister for Public Service and Administration in 2001 was designated by Cabinet to be the one driving the anti-corruption program and framework for the country. The understanding was the orientation had to be one of putting mechanisms in place to get behavioral changes around the aspects of anti-corruption. And it was not dealing with the framework that was focusing on law enforcement, because there are law enforcement agencies that would deal with the end consequences of having identified corruption. So from our perspective, it was what would be the mechanisms to change the behavioral aspects, of anti-corruption. It was also identified that clearly the terrain within government and the spend within government being so large that by and large the internal tendering processes within government would be an area where we'd have to get public servants to understand that in dealing with the private sector, clearly there would be opportunities, for aspects that would be unethical, and hence our obligation was to deal with preventing any aspects of corruption from happening. And hence the mandate given to us in terms of driving that. What you must also understand is, as we went on further, the role of driving the Africa Peer Review Mechanism has got a cross-cutting theme of dealing with anti-corruption, and the Minister for Public Service and Administration had been the designated nodal point and focal point of driving the Africa peer review mechanism, and hence the correct location in terms of driving the anti-corruption agenda. So that's just giving a background in terms of why the location within the NPSA. Now, as we are going forward in government in terms of the outcomes-based perspective of government, one of the key things that government is looking at in 2010-2014 as part of Outcome 12, which is an efficient, effective and development-oriented public service, is a key focus on tackling corruption. So there is an output that is going to be measured in this term of government as to how far we have gone in dealing with the structures and the measures and the capacity building in terms of tackling corruption effectively. And hence that is part of our broader mandate as well. So that is giving you an overview in relation to the background of our particular mandate. Now, in terms of the measures, in 2002, Cabinet approved the Public Service Anti-Corruption Strategy. And that particular strategy then, has gotten broader in terms of how we need to be dealing with the whole public sector. And hence you will see, as we speak to the draft public sector anti-corruption framework, the strategy has gone beyond the public service insofar as we need to put mechanisms in place. I'll also be speaking to the aspects of the public service charter, which is a revision of the ethical code for public servants in what is expected in terms of the attributes, the principles, as well as the qualities of public servants insofar as they should not be party to activities that can be construed as corrupt. The Public Service Anti-Corruption Strategy, just to share with you, one of the things in terms of that particular strategy was having an anti-corruption coordinating committee which would be responsible for the implementation of the Public Service Anti-Corruption Strategy. That particular committee has been in place and it's been driving the actual strategy. The strategy has been in place, as I've indicated, since 2002, after we were given the mandate in 2001 to drive it. And there was a comprehensive audit that was undertaken in the financial year 2005-2006 to look at whether we have implemented the issues in terms of establishing the structures, signing international agreements, as well as putting measures in place in terms of dealing with the aspects of corruption. From the actual audit, in terms of the planning part of the audit, there has been a 96% implementation achievement insofar as we have identified the gaps and put the mechanisms in place. That part of the strategy we have concluded, in the sense that the instruments that we are putting in place, which are in the advanced stages of consultation, are addressing the issues of post-public service employment. We've also gone further in terms of how do you get private citizens to participate in disciplinary hearings where they are coming into disciplinary hearings of public officials in terms of giving evidence. And that is quite a remarkable step in making it a collective process in terms of citizens, in terms of big business, and in terms of the public service, in relation to addressing issues of disciplining employees that fall foul of the code. Also, the inclusion of ethics audits in the annual reports. You will start seeing that in relation to the Auditor General's report, blind departments have to include information as to whether individuals have been disciplined and the nature and the type of misdemeanors, especially in relation to corrupt activities in line departments. Also, the mobilization of public service unions in the fight against corruption. You will record that we had a public sector summit in March, and one of the declaration resolutions from all our public sector unions is that they are going to be party to the fight against corruption insofar as public servants are involved in corrupt activities. In terms of the framework, as I indicated to you earlier on, the public sector integrity management framework is one of the strategies that has emanated out of the broader public service strategy, because we say the public service strategy cannot narrowly only be focusing inwardly on the public service, because it takes two to tango in relation to corruption, and it's a broader societal issue. So clearly, in terms of the public sector integrity management framework, how do we make it broad that it includes aspects of the parastatals, aspects of local government, and also the public service, and hence it's much broader than ourselves narrowly as the public service. But the framework is aimed at strengthening and regulating good governance and probity in the broader public sector, because we define the public service as narrowly as those that are covered under the purview of the Public Service Act, but the public sector are all those that receive money from the government fiscus, and hence it's much broader than that in terms of the parameters. But our understanding is that it will achieve the simplification of the implementation of the existing ethical codes and anti-corruption measures in order to improve compliance, because there'd be some degree of uniformity in relation to how the sector needs to revise their codes as to what is acceptable and what is not acceptable in terms of behavior. Also, the aspect with regards to the categorization of the different degrees of corruption in terms of the disciplinary codes, the understanding is that there would be some sort of uniformity, and those sorts of issues then would start regulating the behavior in the broader public sector if we get a uniform understanding in terms of good governance issues in relation to how we are all adjusting our regulatory frameworks that are in place. But also the promotion of integrity and good governance and striving to build a more accountable and efficient public service. What the framework also achieves to do is it's putting measures in place to ensure that appropriate action is taken in the event of non-compliance. And clearly the appropriate disciplinary action, the recovery of losses, prosecution and sanctions. Because currently, within our current public service disciplinary code, as an example, there isn't a category for sanctioning on corruption. There's just general categories of sanctions for misdemeanors. But you will not get, for argument's sake, if you're looking at an education disciplinary code, if an educator is found to be selling exam papers, it's automatically a dismissible offense. And hence, you know that is a defined sanction. And hence, what we are saying for the public service code, we have to go back and look at defined sanctions for anything that is regarded as corruption. And therefore, it must be something that public servants know that it should be a dismissible offense if it is anything dealing with corruption. The framework is also undergoing a consultative process. We must indicate that it's been extremely extensive in terms of the consultation. We have presented it to the whole cluster system, the working groups, the task teams, as well as at foresight level. And just the thinking in relation to endorsing the mandate, it has gone to the Governance Cabinet Committee to get buy-in, and it is still in the working groups of the cabinet, of the cluster system, before we take it through the cabinet processes. It's also been through the Anti-Corruption Coordinating Committee, so there's been quite a rich input in relation to the thinking of this particular framework. But the measures that the framework attempts to address, it's a compulsory financial disclosure for all public servants. Currently, the financial disclosures are only at the level of SMS. And clearly, we're also proposing a revision of what the financial disclosure should be asking, because we're indicating that there isn't sufficient information for us to be able to make certain relational connections from the current financial disclosure forms, and therefore it's under revision at this particular point in time. But also the prohibition of public servants from conducting business with government, those are one of the proposals in the draft framework, and clearly that is under consultation in relation to the implications of that, whether it should be a blanket prohibition or whether it should be a regulated prohibition in relation to certain categories. Because clearly the debates that are coming up in relation to smaller rural areas and the role that public servants play in terms of driving local economic activities, those are still under the debate in relation to what would be the implications in terms of a blanket prohibition. But we public servants are requested to recuse themselves and disclose in writing to the ethics officers from any processes in which their family members or business partners may stand to benefit from a contract conducted with departments, because we're cognizant of the fact that it is extremely difficult to regulate the activities of spouses and family members as independent citizens, but we can regulate the conduct of public servants themselves. So what mechanisms do we put in place in the line departments that we have designated ethics officers whose role it is to make sure that those particular public servants in carrying out their duties are not conflicted in relation to any relational aspects of persons who may be doing business with government that they are associated with. Yeah, so we can come with a prohibition around public servants themselves in terms of employment relation, but how do we manage that for the spouses and the family members? That is what we are still grappling with in terms of the framework. But also the prohibition of public servants from accepting gifts of any value from private entities, that has also been clearly spelled out. The prior approval before undertaking remunerative work outside the public service, because clearly we're cognizant of the fact that there are selected categories of employees in the medical profession, for argument's sake, and the educational professional categories, who for the preconditions of their particular professional registration with council have to still carry out certain duties. For argument's sake, educational psychologists, there are certain periods in terms of them still functioning as professionals if they are in pure teaching, where they should be allowed there to conduct in order for them to continue to remain registered with the particular professional council. So there are certain categories where the professional councils will assist us in terms of the prerequisites for registration, where prohibition would then be limited in those instances. But the appointment of ethics officers, we are clear that every line department should have a designated ethics officer whose role it is to deal with the actual conduct of employees insofar as they are breaching the code of ethics, which is completely different from the labor relations officer who's dealing with normal line function labor relations matters in terms of upward communication through grievances and downward in terms of discipline and so forth. So the ethics officers is a different category of employee in terms of looking after the interests of government. In terms of the charter is also one of the issues that has taken two aspects. The Batopili principles that we're going to be speaking in the later presentation and marrying that, because the Batopili principles is actually dealing with the behavioral conduct of what is expected from public servants insofar as they carry out their duties. But the existing code of conduct, how we then revise the actual principles and marry the constitutional principles that are in the code, in the Batopili principles, embedded in the Batopili principles, but what is in the code of conduct, and those are then lifted into the charter. The draft charter that is under consultation, in fact, we do have plans in terms of a formal launch later on in the year, during Public Service Week in September. We would be sharing with public servants our expectations from the code and the Batopili principles that have been crystallized into five ethical principles, for the public cater of employees. And then the attributes that are built from the ethical principles, the nine commitments that are built from the five ethical principles, the seven rules of engagement of how public servants need to engage with courtesy, dignity, respect, those that are incorporated in the Batopili principles, and then the commitments of the public servants. That is what constitutes the actual public service charter. But what we're saying, if we can embed and get public servants to live, where the charter becomes a living document, then the value system of public servants then would be one that basically deplores something like corruption. And therefore, we've got to deal with the behavioral, ethical, and value system of public servants in order to assist us with the fight against corruption. And hence, we find that the public sector civil service charter is one of the key instruments that need to be popularized as a living document and part of the induction of all public servants and reinduction of current public servants in terms of what is the expectation, because the code of conduct exists, the Batupile principles exist, but how do we translate that into living, living documents? Yes. Now, the structures to fight corruption, there is a interministerial committee on anti-corruption, and the issues that I'm sharing with you have been party to discussions within that committee for guidance in terms of the mandating process, and hence we're quite advanced in terms of the consultative process because the direction has been given by the interministerial committee in relation to what should be covered in the frameworks that emanate out of the broader strategy. We have, as I indicated, the Anti-Corruption Coordination Committee, and then there's a National Anti-Corruption Forum that is made up of big business. Big business is chairing at the moment. It is made up of civil society and it is made up of government, and that is a forum that gets together on a quarterly basis to deal with the issues where each sector then reports against the measures. And this feeds into the international conventions, because I'll speak to the international conventions later. We have to report against the conventions that we have signed, and it's not just for us as a public service, it's for the whole country that we are reporting in that instance. We have also launched the GNA Working Group on Anti-Corruption. As I indicated to you earlier on, one of the outputs, which is output 4 from outcome 12, which our minister is driving, under the monitoring and evaluating department, is the issue of tackling corruption effectively. And hence, under the GNA cluster system, we have now launched a standing working group that consists of all the government departments who are responsible for any aspect of driving anti-corruption. They are party to this particular working group, and there are serious deliverables over the periods that have to be addressed in that, which are from the measures that I have spoken to. But just to share with you, the Anti-Corruption Committee was established in 2003, and basically it's tracking, it plans all the activities for the public service, and what we've decided to do is look at a process later on this month, which is next week, as to how do we collapse the work of the GNA working group, which has been newly established because it falls under a formal cluster system, collapse that with the work of the traditional Anti-Corruption Coordinating Committee, because there's an overlap of the government departments that are party to the Anti-Corruption Coordinating Committee and those that are in the GNA working group. So we will be looking at an efficient way of collapsing them, because the activities are going to be very focused for the next years going forward, and that is the process which we are finalizing. But just to share with you the departments that are party, because I've got there's transversal aspects, there's a law enforcement aspect, there's a behavioral aspect, there's a whole lot of different mandates that different departments have. But in Gestalt, they're all contributing directly to the aspect of fighting corruption. The departments that are south as the convener, we've got defense there, we've got the financial intelligence center there, we've got the DICO, which is International Relations and Cooperation. We've got GCIS, Home Affairs. We've got Justice and Constitutional Development, National Prosecuting Authority, Treasury, the OPSC, COCSA, Public Enterprises, SAUGA, Police, the South African Revenue Services, Special Investigating Unit, Trade and Industry, and then representatives from our provincial offices. But the mandate of this particular committee, from the time it was established, was ensuring that the fight against corruption is fully coordinated and integrated with synergies between elements, prevention, detection, investigation, prosecuting, monitoring. So you'll see that it's all integrated functions, different departments running those. They also would be advising government on regional and international cooperation, including coordination that's in international and intergovernmental forums. It's a system of collecting information, coordination, dissemination, and management thereof, and also formulating proposals on the national anti-corruption strategy to drive it forward. As I indicated to you, we have a review workshop that is going to be looking at the merging of the two structures, the ACCC and the GNA working group, so that we can be more efficient in the way in which the control mechanisms are in place and the tracking and monitoring of how we're reporting to the regional as well as the continental and the international structures. The National Anti-Corruption Forum, as I've indicated to you, is chaired currently by the private sector, and it was established in 2001. The third National Anti-Corruption Summit was held in August 2008, and one of the resolutions of the summit were related to the review of the National Anti-Corruption Forum. And clearly that is under discussion in this particular structure that meets the quota. A workshop was held in April 2010 where the review of the functioning of this particular structure was discussed. So there's an intersectorial task team that is basically looking at that, and they would then be giving recommendations back to the structure in relation to who should constitute it and what should be its substructures and what should be its mandate in assisting in driving the anti-corruption agenda. And the report is due back to the structure by the end of May. Now, in terms of capacity development issues, one of the issues that came out of the strategy is that there needs to be a dedicated anti-corruption unit within the public service whose greatest focus is doing the analysis. You may have seen the Public Service Commission from time to time put out reports, and they basically raised concern that there are public servants that are doing business with government and they registered on the Cipro database and so forth. And this comes up in the financial disclosure unit. But the mechanism to take that and to actively follow through and basically make sure that those particular public servants are investigated, there is no process after the report to do that. So once the report is put out, that becomes a problem. So we have identified that the way in which we need to be dealing with the work of the Public Service Commission in making sure that there's a follow-through is for the establishment of an anti-corruption unit within the public service that would then be able to do the investigations and the follow-through and work directly with the line departments in ensuring that corrective measures have been taken where there has been impropriety in relation to the aspects of corrupt activities by public servants. Also, with Palama, we have designed and registered training programs for public servants as well as the designated ethics officers in terms of how to identify corruption, the classification of corruption, and all the aspects in being capacitated in relation to how to deal with corrupt activities in line departments. So the work is at an advanced stage from an organizational development and design perspective within the DPSA, and part of our mandate is making sure that we have that capacity within the public service that will assist in speeding up the investigations and the conclusion of the anti-corruption cases in collaboration with agencies like the Special Investigations Units, because currently there is no relationship at any level between ourselves and the Special Investigations Unit to follow through in relation to such criminal activities. The other aspect in terms of capacity, we're in the process with our IFMS, which is our Integrated Financial Management System, which is in a pilot phase because we've completed the blueprinting, is we have now created a platform for a corruption management information system for public servants. So we're saying that on that particular system, all the information that comes from the financial disclosures must also be put onto the personnel profile of employees, and therefore it's easy to get itinerary reports in relation to public servants that are doing business, as well as where public servants have either been criminally convicted or they have been disciplined. It must be on one system, which means that it must be on our personnel management system, and hence the IFMS system would be the way to go. So clearly, also moving to, at the moment, we've got a manual filing system for the financial disclosures, which is extremely cumbersome, and hence you're getting a problem with compliance in terms of submission of forms. So moving on to an e-filing system for the financial disclosure would make it much easier, and also in terms of the hyperlinking to relevant databases. And the databases, the whole understanding is that within the space, the open space, of the actual Coordinating Committee for Anti-Corruption, all the different functions that different departments have got that is the Home Affairs, the SAPS, and so forth, and SARS, and so forth, all need to be linked to the same open space to get the same information on one database about corrupt activities. And hence it must not be a hit and miss case, especially where public servants have been involved in relation to corrupt activities. In terms of the training program, as we've indicated, Kalama is implementing the capacity building program. That is quite advanced, and they have started, and I think clearly there needs to be a decision around which levels would have to go on compulsory training in relation to the anti-corruption program, and the decision still has to be made in relation to that, and whether the corruption training, the anti-corruption training, whether it should be compulsory training for certain categories and for employees that work in certain environments. In terms of the international anti-corruption instruments, at the moment we are party to three insofar as we have to report. We have the OECD convention on the bribery of public officials. And then there's the UN Against Corruption Convention as well, and clearly there's the APRM in relation to our reporting. But in terms of the OECD, we as South Africa became the 37th country in 2007 who joined the OECD Working Group on Bribery in International Business Transactions. And I think that was really a watershed decision because of the opportunity to be evaluated internationally as to the efficacies of our structures and our mechanisms to deal with aspects of bribery of public officials. The working group is tasked with monitoring and evaluating countries' efforts to implement the convention through a peer review mechanism that is applied consistently. Maybe we just need to share with you recently in February, we had our second evaluation. Our second evaluation, we at the tail end, we need to go to Paris on the mid-June to respond to the reports. The country evaluation was done by Slovenia and the US, and it was quite an extensive evaluation of whether the mechanisms we've put in place, whether the structures we've put in place, and whether the actual measures are working, and we'll get the report from the evaluation in June. So the convention is relatively narrow, but it's specific in scope, and it's quite powerful though, because it focuses solely on the use of the domestic law in your country to criminalize bribery of foreign public officials. So it applies to both active and passive bribery, but it doesn't apply to forms of corruption that other than bribery, so it's only focusing on bribery in terms of transactions. And it's bribery that is purely domestic in your country, you know, of origin, and it's the bribery which is direct and the direct and indirect recipient of the benefit is not a public official. It doesn't cover that. So the person must be a public official who directly and indirectly benefited from that particular bribe. So that's quite powerful in terms of that. The compliance, we are compliant in terms of what they're expecting us to put in place in terms of our law enforcement issues. The following issues were highlighted for further engagement as part of the phase two evaluation. The requirement of intent to commit foreign bribery, that was a highlighted issue. The prosecution of legal persons and whether penalties for companies are effective and persuasive. The prosecution of persons who committed foreign bribery, partly in South Africa, and the effectiveness of the proposed director of priority crime investigation, because we had to respond to that as a mechanism in terms of dealing with those aspects. In terms of implementation, measures have been put in place to ensure the effective implementation of the convention. From the task team, the different departments that are part of the response. It's ourselves, the National Prosecuting Authority, SAPS, the Financial Intelligence Center, Treasury, DECOS, SARS, DTI, and Justice. The NPA and SAPS are responsible for the proactive and the effective investigation and prosecution of alleged cases of foreign bribery. They had to come before the evaluation and respond as to how they have dealt with those which they did do. We are responsible for the coordination of preventative measures within the private and public sector, because it takes two to tango in terms of bribery of public sector officials. SARS is responsible for ensuring non-tax deductibility of bribes. The financial intelligence sector, they deal with the money laundering aspect of the convention. National Treasury and the Independent Regulatory Board for the auditors, the AG and DTI, they're responsible for the accounting and auditing requirements that the convention is expecting us to have put in place. DICO is responsible for the international cooperation, and Justice is responsible for the mutual legal assistance and the extradition assistance of anybody who was a public official involved in bribery that needs to be extradited if they've left the country. So there have been benefits for us in that the peer review and the benchmarking mechanism. Clearly, we are then measured against international good practice, because there are 30 members to the OECD and 7 non-OECD members. The strengthening of policy, legislative and institutional capacity, that is a benefit because we are learning from international experience as to what needs to be put in place, the processes, the legislative compliance, the structures that need to be put in place, the mechanisms and the measures that would assist us in combating foreign bribery, because there's quite a number of lessons that we're learning from what other countries have done. And for the SACs and the National Prosecuting Authority, they've been exposed to the new techniques for investigation and prosecution of such cases, and we're learning as we are going along. But the leveling of the playing field, the tour de table, which is happening in Paris, because the OECD is resident in Paris, those particular discussions provide a platform for holding developed countries accountable for corruption that they are basically responsible for in developing countries in terms of bribery to do business in those. And the provision of information in terms of efforts, because in terms of the convention, we are sharing information between countries in order to assist prosecution in each one of those countries. And clearly the supply side of the bribery, the focus and the role of multinational companies in the provision of bribes when they're trying to do business or establishing in those countries, because it actually involves public officials for them to be able, in certain instances, to get licenses and to buy land and to be able to establish businesses in those particular foreign countries. And hence, that has been a benefit in terms of us understanding how these multinationals operate with public officials, but also the proactive investigation of these particular cases. In terms of the UN conventions, South Africa ratified the United Nations CAC, the Convention Against Corruption, in November 2004, and it's a legally binding instrument, so we have to report against it as to whether we are meeting the conditions, which are extremely similar to aspects in other conventions. We are also part of the implementation review group that was established in 2009. This is with the review of the convention. And the first meeting took place in 2010 of the implementation review group for the United Nations Convention against Corruption. In terms of the APRM, the APRM, we acceded to the APRM in March 2003. That was in Abuja, Nigeria. The MPSA was appointed to map out a strategy for the country, and we established the National Governing Councils and the TTCs as well in the provinces. It's a whole cross-section of society, business, civil society, and the public service, and we have to then track the cross-cutting themes. One of the cross-cutting themes is around corruption and how we are putting mechanisms in place to curb corruption within South Africa. We would then be giving our second report in Ghana in July, and clearly they would respond in terms of from the country review whether we have we are progressing. But at the APRM level, it is the Transparency International Bribe Payers Index that is used to measure the public perception in each of the countries and outside the country as to whether we are increasing. I think the last our last index was 50. We were 54, 55. We were 55 on the in terms of the ranking of countries in the perception internationally. as to where we are at in relation to perception of bribery and corruption. Yeah. In conclusion, what we're sharing with you is clearly the delivery agreement that will emanate out of the agreement between the Minister and the President, which is part of our mandate in driving outcome 12, is to make sure that most of the issues that we have raised in the presentation, how we be addressing the implementation strategies to make sure that those structures are functional and they are mandated, fully mandated, to follow through in a very holistic and gestalt way as to preventing corruption within the public service, and also the continuous capacity building from Palama's side in relation to public servants being aware of what constitutes corruption and how the ethics officers and also the accounting officers make sure that they put mechanisms in place and are trained to deal with it, but also working jointly with the Public Service Commission in that whatever recommendations are coming out of their report, we're then responding in terms of putting in the appropriate structures and measures in terms of making sure that we are reducing the aspects of corruption within the public service. But clearly, the activities will include conducting public perception surveys and the implementation of a national standardized ethics campaign for the public sector. And you will notice the linkage between the concluding remark as well as the Butterfield presentation, because you cannot separate the two in relation to the conduct of public servants and how they carry out their duties in relation to the aspect of their attitudes towards issues of bribery and corruption. Thank you.
Thank you, Tisha. Honourable members, that was the presentation about the anti-corruption. It goes that far. I am opening up time for questions, areas of clarity, and areas of discussion. Honourable Sanskarsby, followed by Honourable Bikani, Honourable Suka, then Honourable Manilek. I will end up with Mahali. Honourable Sanskarsby.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Clark, thank you very much for the presentation. To me, it was quite clarifying. Corruption is really a cancer, which our public service can't do with. So it's very important, this whole business. The policy that's set out here, I can't disagree with. But the main thing is, it doesn't help, you've got a policy, but that policy is not implemented. Then it stays something written on paper. The public service charter to me is very optimistic, is a very good thing. I don't know about the consequences of people being corrupt in the public service. I'm a bit worried about that, because every public servant must know that if I enter into corrupt activity, there will be a consequence. To me, that is very, very important. I want to go as far as to say that we've got to accept a zero tolerance attitude in our public service. Mm. I'm sure there's much more that's going to be said. That's the main thing I wanted to say.
Honourable Sanskarsby, thank you. Will be followed by Honourable Bikani.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for that. The presentation was fantastic. Nice.
Thank you.
But it's not at the level of public service. It's not at all. It's somewhere flying up there. My worry about it is that in terms of implementation processes, this sounds to me more like theory. It's about to happen. But the question is when. It's long overdue. if you look at where you are actually stating about the Batsopile principles, how many times hasn't the Batsopile principles been revised? It might be an issue where we might take that question over when we've had the presentation from the Batsopile people. But my concern is that we've been talking, if I remember as far back as 2006 plus minus, around the 6-5, when the review started of the Batsopile principles, a whole rollout plan was worked throughout provinces, I remember, where provinces were sort of re-inducted or retrained into issues of Batsopile. Why? Because there was a problem of implementation. There wasn't realistic proof that the effectiveness in terms of the Batsopile principles. Now what's there that's the same from what's going to be put in here? That's how, in fact, I'd like to know is what exactly are you going to do differently? What's exceptional about it's appreciated, the anti-corruption program, but in as far as implementation is concerned, I'm still worried about it. Then, in terms of your monitoring and evaluation processes, you mentioned somewhere inside that you are more about the outside world evaluating us. But what are we doing within the department to be in touch and be realistic to the departments, the public servants? Because I think one of the issues that's always been a problem, and that is part of what's contributing to the corruption that's happening in the departments, is that people are not even inducted in these issues. There's no induction processes that are in place for them to get an understanding that in terms of me committing myself to this particular employment, this is what I need to adhere to. How many will actually be included in the programs, the training programs that you're mentioning, within the public service department at lower management level? All the relevant people must be put on board in this whole process. I'm not convinced about what I'm hearing yet. And then there's the issue of the other thing about this whole thing is the organizational structure, human capacity and human resources. Do you actually have an organizational structure in place to ensure that there are people who are directly involved with this anti-corruption program? And are they part of the organizational structure? What is the budget allocation in relation to this whole program? What are the time frames in terms of the various challenges that we have of corruption within the public service areas? I don't see that clearly indicated except of cabinet and perhaps higher management doing this and doing that. I'm not saying we cannot have interrelations with issues of interrelations or outside government in terms of evaluation and monitoring, but I'm yet to see you showing us a tool or even a framework that talks directly to us, the public servants in the department, and making processes implementable for them to can also understand and practice. Because if you look at even this issue of the Batsopile principles, we put up these beautiful charts that we spent money on. When it's convenient, in particular conferences or summits, we bring up these topics and the principles thereof. We mention that it's part of legislation or part of policy implementation, but the action to it, we don't see it. And at the end of the day, you don't know what the evaluation processes are there. What do you do exactly to ensure that there's a continuous monitoring or evaluation or success factors or areas that need improvement in terms of the program that you've put out here? In terms of prioritizing, if you look at this OECD anti-bribery convention, I'd almost say that you are doing things back to front. Because if you're going to look at, we're not saying this is not a priority, but I would have thought that there was something more in place locally, nationally, within South Africa, within the department, of a similar structure. And if there are representatives of this convention within our country, I would have been more interested in knowing these people and what their framework is or implementation processes are in terms of this program of action, so that we can make it more realistic for the people who the corruption is directed to within the public service. Thank you, Chair.
Sure.
Oh, one, sorry. Just one more. Sorry. Now, the issue of Palama, I hear you concentrating a lot. Maybe it's because of the budget vote speech that we had. It was an indication that Palama is now key in training. But it brings up to me, because if you had to ask Palama now, can you give us a framework or a training program, a detailed program in relation to this anti-corruption program? I doubt you would get it. I'm challenging you guys for that. Can we have that? And can we get an indication from Palama Chair, maybe at a later stage, that when they do come and make a next presentation to us, this must be one of the programs, because I believe that continuity and ensuring that there's you know, a way of monitoring these processes are really happening. It's not just theory, like I feel that this document is actually theory. We need to have coordination and continuity and perhaps integration of some of these programs. And this must become evident wherever we discuss, because there's obviously a budget allocation for that. Thanks, Chair.
Good morning, Chairperson. Thank you, Chair. I must appreciate this presentation. It was quite eloquent and very clear to us. And it tells us that there is work that has been done somewhere to improve the situation of the public sector. My approach would be that we are being ranked number 55 in terms of the rankings. My first question would be that number 55, is it in the world? Are we comparing ourselves with, because we must compare apples with apples, we are in developing states. And does this come out of those developing countries or within a particular context? Where are we in Africa in terms of this ranking? Because if it's holistic, then there is a problem. And also, do we measure ourselves with those developed countries? Yet we are a developmental state. We have not yet arrived at that point. At what level do we measure ourselves with our equal partners to check whether we're making progress? Because I don't want us to chase the Mount Kilimanjaro whilst we're still there, at the autonomical level. The second point in terms of this ranking, in that ranking, solid is number one before 55. Have we engaged with those the top five? Let's assume the top five. Have we taken the best practice from them? Where do we stand? What good lessons can we get out of them? The top five, because this number of 55 out of what country, to me, gives not a good impression to the outside world. And also around this ranking, are also, I don't want to say the Arabic states, where are they in the equation of this ranking in terms of their good governance? Because if you focus only on the Western side, and not look in other areas where we don't want to talk about where are they. I'm just thinking of a good term for the Arabic states. Because you seldom hear about their good practice and lessons, how they manage that, because I understand they are very harsh when it comes to corruption and so on. I would want to hear from yourselves. The second issue, Chairperson, you see, I'm taking a leap from here because I also had this, that it seems to me it's too high level. On the ground, in provinces, surely there are those provinces that cause us a disfavor when it comes to the public image. And I'm not sure whether you have a pilot project to say this one, though I would like to mention, if we say Eastern Cape always corrupts, do you have some pilot project to say we'll turn around that so as to see our policies and principles are working in a particular province so that we don't paint all provinces as a country the same, so that we can measure that we have piloted against what we have. I know there are national departments also at the level of this level, where you can also pilot to say it has been getting a qualified report from the AG for the past number of years because of the manner in which they behave. So we make an intervention so that we change the situation. Or are you just painting all of them the same? Well, because we must claim to say at the end of the day, in this department, we've identified the vacancy rates, the morale is low and all that, but we've managed to turn around that situation in the public eye so that we complement what the president wants to see with what you are doing. Currently, the president is saying, let's change the way we do things differently. And as such, I would hope that you are also trying to do that. But the real strategy, what is it there, both provincially, nationally, let alone at the local level. The other issue, Chairperson, would be, for me, the documentation. You know, I can see that we are saying this has been coming from a particular era historically, I agree. But this is a new administration in 2009. Some of us are very new. We have just arrived here in the last year, and we refer to documents. You know, the outcome number 12. I don't see those things. Can I be empowered with some of your documents that you are referring to, especially around this one on the corruption, anti-corruption, because it seems to me there's a lot of documentation that we need to catch up with. And I don't want to shoot from the hip on some of these things, or to be seen as too naughty in understanding what is happening. Chairperson, on the issue of the audit, on the issue of the audit, there was, I'm sure, at a particular financial year, I know the public service administration, there is a booklet they normally produce for the country to say, in terms of our public service, how they perform, the leaves, the corruption cases we won and so on, all that. Because we would want to have a baseline, an entry point to say this administration under the acting DG came in when the situation was this. So that also we can measure whether you are making an impact. So there should be an entry point, because you cannot just paint it to say we have done this. But surely you must say this financial year, the situation was like this. When we evaluate and assess or do oversight in terms of the annual reports, we can see whether there have been strides made on those milestones that are very specific to the department. This one is more generic in terms of the global world, the global vision, and so on, but also trying to zoom in South Africa in that context. I agree. So I'm saying, Chairperson, we need to have that kind of a situation. Otherwise, I appreciate, Chair, the strides, the eagerness that is there in the department trying to put things right. But surely, we must have a baseline to say this is our entry point for the country. We can be measured in this way by the year of the financial year so that we move forward. And I know it's not static, it's dynamic. For instance, on this issue of the anti-corruption, my last point, or this point of the audit, you know, there are departments, I'm not sure whether you've done that, a particular department has got more directors than any other department, and yet the population that they serve is very little. And every official that is found to be suspended, when he comes back, is awarded a senior position rather than to be reprimanded or to be retrained. That's the thing that I wanted to bring on this issue of the audit. There are departments that are bloated by senior position rather than to do the work on the ground. And those departments are not filling in vacancies at the lower levels. They are just floating themselves up at the senior level. And what is your intervention at that level? So I'm saying there are those serious concerns. Others from other provinces, if a civil servant is found to be guilty, I'm not sure whether you also have an audit to say you have a black spot to this civil servant. Because what they did, what they do normally, as I heard in this, as I'm moving around, you are found guilty or is it guilty in this province, and you are poached by another province and you are given that another senior position, whilst you have been found on the wrong side of the law in a particular province, you are just transferred to another province to be rewarded for what you have done wrong in another province. So I'm saying there are those kinds of things. And it seems to me our tracking scheme and our vetting approach is not quite good when it comes to that. Thank you, Chair.
Sure. Thank you, Honorable Suka. I will follow up by Honorable Maluleke.
Thank you, Chair. The last point that was raised by Honorable Suka, which is mostly challenged, Northwest, it won't recover because they take people from particularly free states.
People who
were charged corrupt in the state, bringing them to Northwest, which it has its challenges. So we can. Thank you, Chair. The issue of disclosing, it has its challenges because the public servants are taking advantage that if I have disclosed, then his or her company will work because he has disclosed. So they will also take their companies to work to the same department because they had disclosed to the department. So it's still a challenge that after disclosing, they will pay their maybe relatives' companies in advance before they do work, and that is the challenge that we have. The other challenge that needs to be addressed is the issue of bribery. I think this thing in South Africa is challenging. Today you can't have a license without bribery. It's a cancer that has Skalbeck talk about. If you don't have bribery, you can't have a license because for employment is another thing. So it needs to be addressed seriously. And the issue of implementation, let me join the show. Maybe it will win the competition. The issue of implementation is a challenge. We have knives and presentation from the department, which will manage the, you see South Africa as a developing country. But when it comes to implementation, we fail. Maybe we are number 55 on the presentations, not the real 55. Because on presentations, but if we can implement these things, we'll go far. That's South African. So I'm also joining the song chairperson for maybe urging the departments to implement their policies. Policies are good in presentation, but implementation is another part. So if you can do, you can address this challenge of disclosing and make some measures that even if the person is disclosing his or her department, but she should not have a business with the department, this will solve the challenge because there are some SMEs who are not even working, looking for this for the department, and they will always, every day fall down because you have interest in your department. So you can assist this poverty in South Africa if you can deal with this challenge. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Last on the list is Honorable Mahali.
Thank you, Chairperson. Acting DG, this was a very nice presentation. I don't want to join the song. I'm not going to join this song. I know that you are going to make it work. So my first question is, the DPSA has been in the driving seat since 2001. Can we get the picture?
what has been happening, about 10 years, what has been happening. I don't want to say the 55%, I'm not sure, but where are we since 2001? Which departments have been improving? Which ones haven't been improving? Can we get those statistics? Because I don't think it's all doom and gloom. There are those that some work has been done, there are those that some work hasn't been done. And can I get a clear picture of the relationship between this anti-corruption and the National Anti-Corruption Hotline? What is it that is going to happen there? But the National Anti-Corruption Hotline, but the DPSA Anti-Corruption Framework. Going forward, 2010, 2014, what is your relationship? What is going to happen there? And like Honorable Suga has said, which are the top five countries? What have they done? Which is the top country in Africa? In Africa, which one can we compare us with? If you look at our demographics and whatever, which country can we compare ourselves with? Because we cannot just compare ourselves with any other country. Financial disclosure, like they said, you say it's for senior managers, for everybody, but where can we draw the line to say if I have disclosed, even if I have disclosed, my company will still get a job in any way? Then what kind of work will I do as they? If I haven't done my work, what will happen? Because I've disclosed my company, was awarded this tender, then what? I'm going to spend more of the time, not at work, but doing that the job that I was awarded. Maybe if you could get somewhere, whatever, to say that public servants are not allowed in whatever way to be involved in tendering with the public service. And thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah, Honourable Member, thank you for the questions that you have raised there, because largely I'm covered on a number of issues that you have raised, and I believe that with this interaction, the department is improving upon spaces and on issues that are actually raised in terms of taking up. What it's becoming very clear is that we really want to move away from allegations when you talk about this corruption in the country to the actual facts, you know, so that we talk about things that are tangible, like, you know, something that you can touch, feel, or see. And of course, corruption is there. We can't even argue, debate, but it has, you know, our systems are wishy-washy in terms of actually saying, you know, how do we deal with it? And I must say the presentation setting to address those areas, we are satisfied about the initiative that the department is taking in terms of assisting us to capture the corruption, which also hampers service delivery, you know, as we know, most of all good things that the government is meant to deliver for the poor do not reach them based on this kind of corruption. And really, the tangible system such as what you are actually indicating is quite good. What also pleases in terms of the presentation, we capture even how we're going to bring on board the civil, the private citizens. You know, how then do we, you know, because you've hired somebody, you've got a contract with that person, that somebody else is involved. So it covers quite a large area. So we, like all other members have said, want to talk more about putting the system into test, you know, starting to work. And I want to believe the next meeting on this matter that we're going to have would be, we've implemented these and things, this is how this it works. Because that's the language that the members are talking about, you know. So we're going to be saying progress of what we actually talked about, good as it is, it's moving at this level. You know, we can range from, you know, from the first to the last honourable member, implementation processes are critical. Yes, you know, in terms of talking about it, if Honorable Pican talks about the theoretical aspect of it, that's a view, the practical application of the system. You talked about the ethic officers, you know, and the members would be interested to see the warm bodies, the structure, the setting of function, the database, issues identified on the register, maybe where the public can actually refer to and so on. Quite practical, so which is very possible in terms of the presentation. I wouldn't really want to say much because members have actually covered all other areas. I would leave it to yourself to actually respond when you feel it's necessary, but also emphasize the fact that as a committee, we are going to give a period of time for the department to actually start on the processes, and we will call the department back, you know, sometime. We will assess ourselves in terms of how much time on very tangible things that have already happened in terms of implementing this program that you have already outlined to us. You know, further to that, I know there are a number of other reports that have been submitted to Parliament by Public Service and Public Service Commission, which, you know, alludes to a number of, you know, wrongdoings, corrupt practices and so on, which we would like to actually start to implement. And I must say, in terms of your presentation, it looks like we're moving towards sort of synergizing, integrating and bringing these systems together to work in a way that can be in the government. And then giving to you another Mrs. Black.
Thank you. All announcements, you know, on this issue. In my party organization last week, we discussed this at length. As a result, it will culminate this coming Friday. There's a march on anti-corruption.
Wonderful.
In Port Elizabeth.
Wow.
Anti-corruption and crime. Those are the two central issues that we have in our area. So
yes.
I'm saying I'm very interested on the matter. We can deliberate more. But I'm confining myself to a presentation, but there are broader issues that we can discuss at another stage. There is a march this coming week for this anti-corruption.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, honorable members, and thank you very, very much for the encouraging comments and the direction that you're providing in relation to the aspects of the implementation. I just want to take you back to one of the pertinent issues that I raised in the presentation around the establishment of the anti-corruption unit within the public service. This advanced work that has been done around the actual structure and the mandate and the proposal at this particular point in time is what corporate form this particular structure should take. And our understanding is that it shouldn't be a branch in the Department of Public Service and Administration. It should be given teeth and be a government component that can have quite wide-ranging powers and authority in terms of aspects of public service corruption. That will also deal with the question that Honourable Member Bakina raised around organisational structures, because our proposal is there needs to be line function between the structure and the people in line departments who are going to be dealing with the aspect of anti-corruption in line departments, because currently it doesn't exist. The process of anti-corruption is just handled by the Director of Labor Relations, and it's always just been dealt with as a labor relations function in terms of ordinary employee discipline. Now, we're saying it needs to be taken out of that particular realm and dealt with, because there's two fundamental issues. Under the Treasury purview, Treasury is responsible for the issue of supply chain management and procurement. They're also responsible for the database of issues around people registered with companies and registering people who have been convicted for corrupt activities. That is the legal mandate given to them. So it's how does this particular anti-corruption unit collaborate with Treasury, who's got a mandate to manage that on behalf of the country, versus us managing it just for public servants, because our purview would only then be for public servants insofar as they have been involved in corrupt activities. So clearly it's a matter of the revision of a capacity and component with inline departments that would be dedicated to deal with it, and also linked with the mandate of Treasury, and how does this anti-corruption unit then have the teeth to be able to summons and to do aspects you know, in terms of prosecuting in relation to corrupt activities. That's dealing with the structural issues. The aspect in terms of the concerns around implementation, clearly they are valid in relation to what the existing framework in relation to a decentralized human resources framework has had its limitations insofar as a national department like ours dealing with aspects of employees in provincial administration being involved in misdemeanors. So clearly this anti-corruption unit would then actually be above that particular limitation insofar as we are able, you know, to intervene. The role of the Commission, as you've highlighted, is extremely important in terms of they are the ones who are managing the hotline. And what they do is they disseminate whatever comes from them to line departments directly to investigate. So it doesn't come to us as DTSA. It goes directly to the line departments to investigate. Now, if this anti-corruption unit was in place, the relationship would be whatever's coming through the hotline in the Public Service Commission then goes directly to the anti-corruption unit to make sure that the follow-through happens as well as the appropriate action is taken. And therefore some report in a holistic way can be given rather than the disparate way in the sense that when it is referred down to line departments, the hope is that there's going to be follow-through and they're going to report in their annual reports if there's any action, appropriate action that has been taken. And clearly that's been a hit and a miss arrangement in relation to that. So in terms of the working arrangement and the delivery loop in relation to the conclusion, the anti-corruption unit would then be the place to sort out the modalities of how those happen. And clearly the whole monitoring and evaluating function as well would be the one located within that particular unit, because at the moment it's not located anywhere in relation to the DPSA environment specific to anti-corruption. It is only what the Public Service Commission is putting out at this particular point in time, and therefore definitely there is a gap and we'll deal with that. I think the point is well taken and noted with regards to the focus externally versus the focus internally. What the strategy does, if we go back to the actual public service strategy, the intention is to focus internally in terms of putting the mechanisms in place. But we cannot detract from the fact that the mandates in relation to what should be going into the internal, the external is the one that assists us in terms of what needs to be in those from best practice. And hence, once the framework has been endorsed, as well as the unit is endorsed, the unit is the one that's going to be the internally focused for the public service, and then therefore we would be getting a more focused reporting on the work of that particular unit, because that particular unit then would be responsible for reporting upwards on the for the mandate of the public service into the National Coordinating Forum. So the National Coordinating Forum, by and large, is supposed to be the country structure with civil society, business, and government, who then is reporting upwards. But I think the limitation is we're not getting a sense of the reporting downwards in relation to what's happening in the country. And clearly the need for the review, which we spoke to in terms of the task team that was set that met in April, for the NACF, was actually highlighting that in relation to what should be the parameters of their mandate, and therefore you'd be able to get the necessary reporting. But because this is an ongoing process, I think what the chairperson is raising in terms of reporting on a periodic basis to get the sense of the implement, because we firmly believe that once the anti-corruption unit is in place, a lot of the questions that the members have asked, that unit will then start responding to it in a tactical way. Because clearly it's been at a planning stage in terms of trying to put the structures in place to be able to be responsible for the implementation. Now, with regards to the ranking, we are ranked 55 out of 180 countries that are part of the Organization for Economic Development, the OECD. there are certain countries that have exceeded, and there are certain countries that are non-aligned countries. But we are 55, and our ranking has gone down in real terms, because the last ranking, we were ranked at 50. I took off to me a little bit the details there.
In terms of the Transparency International, in which year, 2007, we are ranked 54 out of 180 countries with a score of 4.7, which basically means that we're actually below the clean. Five is sort of going up to clean. And in 2008, we're ranked 55 out of 180 with a score of 5.7. So it's actually improved. The number gets influenced by the number of countries that are included in the index. The more countries you have, then your score will be dropped. But what we should be looking at rather than the score is rather than the ranking, the actual score. So it's actually improved from 4.7 to 5.7, which is slowly going, moving towards 10 instead of moving towards 0, which is not too viewed as clear.
Okay. Now, in terms of the question, the Scandinavian countries are in the top five, Norway, Sweden, and so forth. For Africa, Botswana is ranked as number one in terms of the countries that are participating in the ranking system. So that gives an indication. In terms of your question, whether we have had any engagements with the top countries in relation to baseline, I'm not aware of any formal engagement at this particular point in time, but I think that's a very important issue that has been raised. But in relation to the Arabic states, I don't think we can give you a firm response to that, because in terms of the classification, it is just dealing with the countries that are parties to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. But what we can provide you with is the list of all the countries and the ranking and the scoring, which would give you an indication of the explanation that that Tamela has given. In relation to the aspects about persons moving from provinces to provinces, the amendments in the Public Service Act in 2008, April 2008, made it possible for a person who was under investigation or being charged in a department, for the new department that recruits them, to basically continue and finish off with the charging. There is a legislative amendment to allow that, so that person is not let off the hook. That's the one issue. But I think the issue that you raised, which is important, was what we're trying to address with the CMS system, the Corruption Management Information System, on the IFMS system. We're saying that information would then be available to all recruiting departments to know if it's been flagged on the system, any issue that is of concern, a red flag, with regard to the person that you're recruiting when you're doing the vetting, so that information should be freely available on the system in future once we have concluded that, and hence the need for that. So it won't be information that is only necessarily available within the public space. It would be all the bodies that basically are participating at the level of the Anti-Corruption Coordination Committee for their own purposes, why they would need that information in their own vetting. That's the response to that particular issue. With regards to the organograms and the bloated organograms, the mandate of a department will determine how a position is job evaluated for the level in which it comes out. So you will see at a national department, you would by and large have more positions at a specialist management level because of the policy nature of the particular positions. But in a provincial level, what you're going to be getting are more operational level positions because they are the implementing arm of the policies. They are not the ones that are coming up with the policies. So in how the positions are job evaluated, it basically determines the level of those particular departments. But in terms of the audit, I think it's important in terms of what you're raising, because at this point in time, there isn't an audit in any ranking way in relation to what you're asking. But for the mandate of the proposed anti-corruption unit, that would be their particular role, to make sure that on a regular basis the reports are put out in relation to the categorization of the corruption, the misdemeanor, and also the ranking of departments in relation to that. With regards to the financial disclosures, I did indicate the aspect that the shortcomings of the current financial disclosures, it's correct in the sense that people are just closing for malicious compliance purposes, but the issue is whether that information matters for the purposes of tenders, and hence you will see in the second issue that we raised, in the measures that the framework is wanting to address, the proposal for us is prohibiting public servants from conducting business with government, period. And we're saying, is that just so? Whether you disclose or not is neither here nor there. It just helps us to know that if you do decide to tender, you've disclosed and you're not supposed to be doing business with government. So it's a two-way thing. It's a matter of checking also on the CIPRO database in relation to understanding what are the business interests of public servants, because we should have access to that in an open space. So it gives us an indication that if the information of the CIPRO database is available, it helps with the CMS system to reconcile that information on the database, and hence we can deal with the aspect of the actual disclosures. But I think the issue of the Batupile question, we can respond to that after the Batupile presentation, and this would be able to deal with it in a more responsive way. Thanks.
Thanks, in fact, I was starting to panic. We are breaking behind time,
yeah.
Since we're also supposed to do the presentation. We go to round up at 12:30, which seems to be a bit impossible. We might go a little bit above 12:30, but now then it means we're going to congest with the presentation, including the discussion for the second item on the agenda. And I think I can't even give a comfort break, like I indicated before. Let's proceed. And, okay, because we're putting up a presentation, 5-minute stretch, and members can come sit there. It's on.
Mm.
That's great. Do you really need a comfort break of 5 minutes?
No, I can
love that. Okay. Honorable in this case, maybe let's
not about
forward it. Yes, but let's proceed to the presentation on the briefing to us as the portfolio committee on Batupele program for the public service. If the department is ready, can you proceed?
Thank you, Honorable Minister. For the marathon session. Thanks. Just to begin by quoting, the President met with senior managers on the 23rd of April, and I think he encapsulated his concern about Batupele in his statement. He indicated, what we need is a different type of public servant, a public servant who respects the citizens he or she serves, a public servant who values the public resources she has been entrusted to manage. We need a public servant who comes to work on time and performs his or her duties diligently.
Yeah.
Now, with that, the overview in terms of the presentation is just sharing with you the legal background, the 8 principles, the challenges that were identified by the Public Service Commission, what is expected in terms of coming up with a service delivery charter to address those challenges, and the revitalization program that Honorable Member Bettina spoke to, that was supposed to, the Kani was supposed to deal with the identified challenges then. The Batupele Impact Assessment Program that is now looking at addressing those particular challenges, and the revitalization program that has been put in place, and also the coordination of Batupele generally within the public service. Just to share with you, the Constitution basically is the origin for the actual principles in terms of the high levels of professional ethics that have to be promoted, the efficient and effective and economic utilization of the resources, the impartiality, the fairness, the equitable and non-biased way in which we provide services to the public. People's needs have to be responded to, and the policies must be, and the public must be encouraged to participate in the policy-making process. The public administration must be accountable. Transparency must be fostered by providing the public with timely, accessible, and accurate information. specifically what is in the Constitution under public administration. In 95, we had the white paper on the transformation of the public service, and clearly the key thing was that the public service had to be people-centric. People must come first, and Batopile basically must ensure a better life for all. That is the gist of what it was saying. In 97, we had the white paper on transforming the public service, and this basically provided the policy framework and the tactical implementation strategy to improve service delivery. And the Batopile white paper set out 8 principles that must be adhered to for the transformation of public service delivery. Now, why the introduction of Batopile? The rationale for Batopile was a need for commitment to service excellence in how we deliver services in our day-to-day operations to citizens. It is not additional tasks to our daily tasks as public servants, but it's the manner in how we approach delivering our tasks in a professional, efficient, an organized manner which ensures predictable services to all citizens all the time. That's the understanding of what Batopile is supposed to be about. But Batopile is about real professionals doing real jobs, addressing real issues which affect real people, the citizens. And it's how do we make this a living issue in terms of that is what the rationale of Batopile is. But what is Batopile? It's an initiative to get public servants to be service orientated in terms of the rationale. It's a strive for excellence in service delivery. It's to commit continuous service delivery improvement to citizens. It allows citizens to hold public servants accountable for the type of services they deliver. And citizen-oriented approaches to service delivery, which are informed by the 8 principles. Now, the 8 principles basically is a commitment to continuous improvement and innovation, and also to build, the important thing, effective relationships with the end user, the citizen. That's what it's about. The 8 principles basically, if we can just quickly refresh our minds, it's consultation, it's service standards, it's access, it's courtesy, it's information, openness and transparency, redress and value for money. But in a very ordinary way, from the legislation, what is the expectation? The expectation of consultation is that citizens should be consulted about the level and the quality of the services they can expect to receive, and wherever possible should be given a choice about the nature of services that are on offer. The service standards, citizens should be told what level, quality, quantity and frequency of public services they would receive, so that they can be aware of what to expect, where, when, how, and why. The access, all citizens should have equal access to public services which they are entitled to within a reasonable distance from where they live and where they work. Courtesy, all citizens should be treated with dignity and respect irrespective of social or economic background, and citizens should receive a sympathetic and positive response to all complaints and queries. Information, citizens should be given full and accurate information about public services they are entitled to receive, and public information which affects their rights to citizenship so that they can make informed choices. Openness and transparency, citizens should be told how government works, how much services cost, and who is responsible for the delivery of such services. And if such services cannot be delivered, why not? They need to be told that. Redress, where the promised standard of service cannot be delivered now, citizens should be told why, and an apology offered with a full explanation and a speedy and effective access to a solution or remedy which is fair, responsive, and confidential. Value for money, public services should be provided and procured in an economically and efficient manner in order to give as many citizens as possible the best possible value for their money spent on public goods and services. Now, the Batopile value system has got a belief set, and the belief set basically is engaging with employees, we belong, caring for our customers who are citizens, we care, and servicing the public, we serve. So you will see in all public service documents, in terms of our own belief system for DPSA, this is entrenched. We care, we belong, we serve. And each of the Batupile principles are underpinned by the value system, by the belief system, in relation to the principles that I've just shared with you now. The Public Service Commission has shared a number of challenges historically in terms of the public service with regards to the compliance. To Batupile, there was a survey in 2003. And from that survey, what the Public Service and Administration Department did, that's ourselves, was put in the Batupile Revitalization Strategy after the survey results were presented to Cabinet. The challenges were as follows. The Public Service Commission says public servants lack tactical skills to apply the Batupile principles. There's a narrow and uneven interpretation of Batupile. There's no service standards that are set to mediate citizens' expectations of service delivery. Service delivery improvement programs are not aligned with service delivery capacity and resources in departments. Service delivery improvement is seen as a separate campaign and not integrated into the daily core business of departments. Service delivery improvement programs are merely listing procedures without necessarily indicating how an improvement of quality, quantity, and efficiency levels will be attained by departments. But Batupile principles had to change the historical attitudes of how frontline personnel work and behave towards the public in the delivery of services. There's a lack of adherence to basic public administration practices. The Batupile principles had to be incorporated into the performance management systems of all departments. And there's an absence of basic requirements in departments. We an absence of service standards that the public can expect, service delivery improvement plans, signage to departments, redress mechanisms for disgruntled citizens in relation to how services are being delivered. Now, for us, the important thing was then how do we assist line departments in addressing the gaps? And what line departments have been expected to do in terms of the Batupile Revitalization Program is come up with the service delivery charters in their own line departments. What is a service delivery charter? It's a commitment, it's a statement of commitment that department makes towards service delivery based on its mandate, its capacity, and its resources. It reinforces service delivery improvement to all recipients by meeting their reasonable expectations. It's a consultative two-way process which affords all an opportunity to learn about government services provided by a department and the community that department serves. Now, what are the advantages? The advantages of a service delivery charter for a line department is that the understanding of the circumstances, the needs, and the reasonable expectations of citizens are then provided by the charter because you're engaging with those communities. And therefore, you can plan with those communities in relation to understanding that. The charter also allows you to understand the shortcomings and the limitations of your own department and to improve and put an improvement plan, a service delivery improvement plan, which we call the SDIPs, in place. It also allows the department to realize what is possible, what is realistic, and what is doable, and what is not. And in what timelines can those things be done? But it also comes to a deeper understanding of putting people first, because the communities are assisting you in understanding your limitations to then put a timeline in terms of what they're expecting you to do, because they've gotten to understand what you can do and what you can't do. But in setting the service standards together with the community that you're servicing in your sector for that particular line department, the importance is to be extremely specific about the standard, that everybody knows what houses they're going to be expecting, and therefore it's been clearly spelled out. What is measurable in relation to what can be delivered, when it can be delivered. What is attainable, that it's not promises that are unrealistic. What is realistic in relation to the resources and the capacity that department has, and also the timelines that people know within 2 years, we would have done X, Y, and Z, because we all understand that this is the plan and this is how it's going to be delivered. But also that there's a joint evaluation process to see that those things are going to be delivered, and there's also the review process. We something obviously cannot be delivered for some constraint, and therefore there's a feedback in relation to openness and transparency where that can't be done. Now, the revitalization program, which was endorsed by Cabinet in 2004, basically said you have to take public services to the people and put mechanisms in place through the charter as to how that is going to happen. You have to come up with a Know Your Service Rights campaign so that, communities know what their rights are and they know how to access the services. We have to put strategies in place how public servants put the public first and put people first in the way in which they are delivering services and also doing their jobs. We also have to mainstream, institutionalize, sustain, and foster accountability for the implementation of Batopele in those line departments. The additional flagship programs was the mechanisms we put in place in terms of assisting departments, how to go about setting service standards, how to design the service delivery improvement plans for these line departments, and on an annual basis we have been hosting, last year we host the 8th Batopele Learning Network, where we brought practitioners together to explain to us how they were going about implementing. So the Batopele Learning Network is a report back session from practitioners, but it's also learning in terms of best practice, because different departments have put different mechanisms in place that are working and they can share with other line departments in different provinces what's best practice, but they're also coming to learn from themselves and also from international best practice aspects of improvement. We've also got the Batopele Change Management Engagement program in place, and that has been rolled out quite successfully. In terms of the macro understanding of the revitalization process, the whole thing centers around the change of culture and behavior within the workplace. We're saying that in the internal communication and what is happening in terms of organizations, the organizational focus, the staff focus, and the morale of employees is extremely important in terms of how we are embedding a particular culture, in terms of our own internal communication with regards to the people that are driving Batopele. But external to the department, there's a citizen focus, there's a consultation, and there's an information. If citizens are consulted, if citizens basically have got all the information that they need, and if the services that have been delivered are citizen-focused, then the culture of the expectations would then be met with the expectations from the culture of the employees with regard to the services that they have to be delivered. But in terms of back office, the people, the processes, the systems, and the structures have to be in place to be the support to the staff to be able to deliver on those particular services. But in terms of the front office going out on behalf of the public service, for us it's that citizen interface and what are the citizen interface mechanisms, the Tucson service centers as well as the community development workers that then are going to be the face of assisting with the access strategy in relation to how citizens can access services from government. But in terms of the access strategy, that has been developed in 2008. That's around the model of the Tucson Services Centers within the health sector, within the policing sector, within home affairs. It's a mobile unit in terms of going out to citizens, in terms of taking services to citizens. There's a community development workers program, which is then the linkage between communities and public services. How do citizens get to know, how do they access the services, and where are the services? So the geographic information system that we've got in terms of the spatial development for the government precincts, that has been captured on the geographic information system, and it assists with the planning for line departments as to where should a police station be put, where should a school be put, and where should government services be put in a particular locality, in a local precinct, and the different types of local precincts that we have in different provinces. In terms of the Know Your Services Rights campaign, we have distributed 274,000 copies of the booklet. We focused on the second degree and first degree rights. The first degree rights are in the justice cluster in terms of how do people access the criminal justice system for all various aspects in terms of rape, in terms of maintenance, in terms of domestic violence. In the social cluster, how do you then access services and what are your rights in terms of the services that you're entitled to in relation to social grants and in relation to social services that are available to citizens. The Service Delivery Improvement Plan, there's extensive support that has been given to the line departments as part of the Service Delivery Charter as to how do they go out to communities and get those Service Delivery Improvement Plans designed. In the financial year 2009-2010, we had a 60% compliance from departments that had submitted completed Service Delivery Improvement Plans that had been consulted upon in their various sectors, in their various communities, and those have been submitted to us. And these service delivery plans are normally linked to the three-year planning cycle of government so that the budgets that have been given, there can be a realistic understanding of what capacity and resources are available for that period in relation to those particular plans. In terms of the CAIDO project, this has been targeting taking and removing senior management service personnel from the offices and getting them to go out into the field and to do on-the-field training in different sectors to their own comfort zones to get an understanding in terms of cross-sectional aspects, what is happening in terms of the planning that they are doing at a national level, how is it impacting at a local level. And this is compulsory in relation to the SMS handbook, that once every 3 years, SMS members must go out as part of the CAIDO to get an understanding as to what is happening you know, on the ground, and therefore their plans can be better informed. In terms of our change management engagement program, this has been ongoing, and we've had a train-the-trainer campaign going. What I'd do is ask Marcel at the end of the presentation just to give some sort of information as to what training has taken place and at which levels of government has that training taken place, which is clearly focusing on the training around the Batopilia principles in terms of the change management. We have the annual Public Service Week. We go out and we target in one province every year where public servants go and they volunteer and they dirty their hands and they go out to communities and they go out to service delivery points to get an understanding whether Batopile is a living campaign. And this has been ongoing. We have targeted an annual Public Service Week for the end of September this year, where we are hoping to launch the Public Service Charter at that particular annual Public Service Week for the targeted events for this particular year. In Morocco in 2004 and Tangiers, the Africa Public Service Ministers had agreed the endorsement that once a year, the 23rd of June has been set aside for all Africa public servants to observe Africa Public Service Day. And we will be doing likewise this year. And, well, fortunately for us, we have the 2010 FIFA World Cup celebrations, and therefore we have merged that into the whole issue of the fan park event that is going to be happening. Because we'll have a number of visitors from the African continent in SADC also attending at the Fan Park at Birchwood, so we have planned some events around that. And that's all part of the Batopile. Now, going forward, from the last Batopile network last year, there were certain challenges that were experienced by practitioners on the ground in relation to they had raised concern that we have finished learning. Now is the time to implement, and now is the time to measure. And therefore, the impact assessment program is now the real issue in relation to measuring the impact of the actual Batopile learning network. Now, what is the practical implementation strategy and the measure that we've put in place? We've refocused the revitalization into the impact assessment approach, and we're saying that the integrated service delivery approach of looking at all three spheres of government, because what happens at national impacts on municipalities, and you can't separate the issue of service delivery from the planning of what is happening at the national provincial sphere and the impact on local government. Therefore, the whole impact assessment approach must be integrated where we're using Batupele as the vehicle insofar as how we are succeeding. But the allocation of a Batupele principle, one to each of the nine provinces, and therefore that must be the key focus. And on an annual basis, we then do a rotational focus. Therefore, after 8 years, each province would have had an opportunity to have institutionalized and embedded, because in one, where they are trying to focus on all eight, it is difficult for us to measure the impact. But if they are only given one, they will then be sharing with all the other eight provinces what has happened in relation to just that one principle that they are focusing on. But that's been allocated. We've also designed monthly themes for the line departments. And we are still it's in the pilot stage, because the planning only happened in March in terms of the allocation. So the monthly themes then for the dedicated provinces will focus on a Batupele theme, but a principle, but they will also focus on the monthly themes. And the monthly themes are taken from the outcomes approach of government to say that by the end of the year, we need to have a sense of what is going on in line departments, what is going on in provinces, and hence we can then focus on an excellence award program that is emanating from the successes that have been fed back. Now, the key issues to support the implementation, we're saying we have to identify the key service delivery issues. We have to strengthen and develop the appropriate structures at a provincial level that are the ones that must be the ones driving the Batupele impact assessment. And the strategy is to inform and to direct the advocacy and the education. Once we've got the public service charter, there is going to be serious advocacy and education that is going to be needed to institutionalize that particular charter in order for the Batupele principles to become a living campaign. And that is the intention. But what would be then the monitoring and evaluating measures that have to be put in place in order for the impact assessment to be successful? Because each of those provinces must be measured in something against something in order for it to be reported and for a national monitoring and evaluation to be done against what they have done. But also the reporting and the accountability through, we are then going to be having the national impact assessment conference in November, where each of those provinces must come and report back just against their principle, so that we know what are the challenges and what are the mechanisms that they've put in place just around that one principle that has been dedicated to them. Now, we also saying that the encouragement of the revitalization is more visibility around the izimbizas and the site visits, that the izimbizas cannot just be merely for ministers, premiers and MECs together with mayors and councillors going out. They do that at the political level. But public servants have to mirror that and accompany the ministers, the premiers, the MECs, the mayors and the councillors to go and see exactly what is happening, that you do not wait for a service delivery protest to go out and find out what's happening. You need to be doing that as integrated ways of making Batupele a living campaign, because that will seek to improve service delivery by identifying areas of deficiencies in delivering of services long before there is a service delivery protest. So you need to know that long before, so that you can anticipate how you're going to mediate the challenges. Because if you heard about them when you were engaging communities in terms of your service delivery charter and your service delivery improvement plans, you should have already known that there were problems already been identified, and therefore you have incorporated them into your plan. But it also will demonstrate seriously how service delivery is being viewed if public servants are going out on visas and site visits and not sitting in their offices and basically hoping that things are going to happen. But just to also share with you, the visibility of government then would be enhanced if public servants are out there and in the identified sectors. with the themes that have been identified, with the identified by Tupela principle per province, they have been focusing on that particular aspect in terms of their site visits. But also it's a way of monitoring and developing and evaluating the challenges that exist, and also coming up with the joint solutions in the service charter with that sector in relation to that. This is giving you an indication of the allocated principles to each of the provinces. Eastern Cape has been given service standards. They must just focus on coming up all the aligned departments, perfecting all the service standards. Free State, perfecting the openness and transparency principle and the mechanisms, counting value for money in terms of procurement of goods and services, KZN information, Limpopo courtesy, Northern Cape accessibility, Western Cape redress, Northwest consultation, and each province once a year would be given all. So it will be a measure of how each of the others have dedicatedly focused on one, but then in Mpumalanga will focus on all, and then there'd be a measure against the benchmarking of when there's a focus and when one province is focusing on all, and therefore we can assist in terms of how we are then rotating what each province's responsibility is around these particular principles. But in terms of the monthly impact theme, you will see from the five key driving principles from government, the education, safety and security, human rights, health, urban rural community development, youth development, African and international solidarity, women's emancipation, cultural and heritage, children, the rights of children and women, and then the environment, as well as hosting the annual Batupila Impact Assessment. So we're saying from January till November, each year, each of the provinces need to know what is the theme that has been identified. The sector department whose mandate is to drive that will be in the driving seat for that Batupila principle, and then we need to be going out jointly going forward. So for us, that is how we'll be dealing with the impact assessment going forward, and also how do we get to the annual Batupila Impact Assessment Conference at the end of the year, where each one of these sector departments come and report back, as well as the provinces reporting back in relation to how we are trying to institutionalize and make Batupila a living campaign going forward from the revitalization process. So by and large, from the we did present the outcome 12 when we presented our strategic plan to the portfolio committee on the 2nd of March, and we have to drive an efficient, effective, and development-oriented public service. From the Ministry for Performance Monitoring and Evaluating, they have highlighted and taken four outputs that our ministry has to drive going forward, and one of them is service delivery, quality, and access, of which Batupila principles and the mechanisms that we are proposing have basically been highlighted. What that ministry has indicated they're going to be measuring us on in terms of our plan, our own strategic plan and operational plan, are the following. The user, service user satisfaction. How satisfied are citizens with the services that have been provided? And the focus in terms of the five areas in terms of the medium-term strategic framework of government, education and health, for this particular year, are the key focus areas for the satisfaction survey in relation to the mechanisms, the service standards we have to put in place, the costing, what is in the citizen scorecards that they are identifying as issues in the service delivery improvement plans, and how is government responding to those. So that particular ministry would then be indicating in their reports when they're monitoring us as the whole of government, whether there is satisfaction from the end users as citizens around these. The other issue that they're going to be measuring us on is also the public participation, you know, through the outreach programs to show visibility and get a sense that we are responding, you know, to the concerns. The responsiveness. We have to develop the measures to assess the responsiveness. And the key things that have been identified by that ministry is they want to know the provisioning of services in Home Affairs, specifically with reference to IDs, specifically to licenses in licensing centres, specifically to social grants. What are the measures in terms of turnaround time and responsiveness, and whether those services have been delivered to those targeted communities? With regards to access, we have to look at the following. We have to develop targets for maximum distance to be travelled by citizens to access services. But also, the plans have to be integrated in terms of where services can be delivered at one delivery point, the one window in terms of the multitude of services through the Tusang Services Centres. But also, Public Works is part of this particular working group. How accessible are buildings? And how are the plans for the modification of buildings to make sure that citizens as well as employees who have disabilities have easily access to services? The value for money, the baseline information on the cost of services to citizens, how do different line departments come to the conclusion as to the cost of those particular services? And Treasury is driving this, and we are part of this particular task team, in terms of setting the norm for pricing for services in the various sectors. But the collaborative efforts in terms of the mechanism, clearly the utilization of the CDWs as foot soldiers in terms of assisting with how to assist citizens to access the services. The Tusang Service Centres as the key service delivery points for the key identified, the six pro-poor services that are part of the rollout of the pilot. For the general services counters of the Tusang Services Centres. The focus on the frontline institutions that interface with services for the 5+2 priority areas, the health, education, justice and so forth, rural development as well. The utilisation of the AG's office to enforce Batupile implementation through reporting mechanisms. We did that with the HR planning last year, and now we are seeing that it is compulsory now that the AG is going into departments and reporting with the departments that have got HR plans, for argument's sake. So we're saying because it's working and we can get reports on that, we would like the AG to do exactly the same for the Batupile implementation, to have in the annual reports of the departments whether they have got a service delivery improvement plan, whether they've got a service delivery charter, and how they have gone about in terms of addressing the implementation of those particular principles, and therefore it would be easy to have all 146 departments with their annual reports, tracking that. But also the collaboration with local government on the service delivery challenges, because we are saying that the integrated service delivery mechanism is extremely important, because we've got to work in an integrated way in how services are delivered to citizens. Citizens don't care whether you're local government, provincial or national. They want to know that they've got running water from the tap and so forth, and therefore we have to understand how do we work in a collaborative way in order to ensure that that happens. But also to improve the communication with stakeholders and the general public, to identify the service delivery gaps and also to improve the service. But the compulsory compliance measures, that is what we are putting in place with the Auditor General going forward for the next financial year. And what would then be the success and failure indicators, and what would then be the corrective measures that need to be put in place. But the anti-corruption initiatives that we raised in the earlier presentation, those have to be implemented in line with the anti-corruption strategy as part of the compliance. Once that is in place, the protection in terms of the efficient utilization and the distribution of state resources would make it much easier for us to meet the capacity gap, because there seems to be a disjuncture in the choices that are made in how the resources are utilized and the aspect in relation to the service delivery challenges that we have. And clearly the aspect of corruption has entered into the fray with regard to some of the choices that have been made. The coordination, in conclusion, we have basically requested each line department to appoint a Batupile coordinator. Now, we're saying it's not necessarily a new person. It's designating someone who is doing work that is dealing with service delivery, but they have to do it through the lens of Batupile, in terms of Batupile being a living campaign. And hence, every premier's office must have a dedicated person who's driving the public service week in that province, who's driving the site visits and the Eastern visas, who's driving the Africa Public Service Day, who's driving the learning networks. And hence, at a national level, if there is a dedicated person in the provincial offices and a dedicated person in each line department, then we know what the line function is in relation to the impact assessment in terms of being able to feedback what is happening in each line department. And clearly that would help us in terms of managing the implementation of the Batupile principles, but also how do we get the Batupile principles also mainstreamed into the integrated development plan, the departmental policies as well as the programs. Because at the moment, one of the challenges that the Public Service Commission has highlighted is that it is seen as an add-on and a standalone. It is not living within how the departments are planning as to the orientation and how they are basically doing their work. Thanks.
I think it is to take that rush in terms of making the presentation, but we have covered it all despite the squashed time. Honorable Vikani will be leaving for a meeting that has started at 15 minutes to 1, and I will just give you an opportunity to go through your questions to the agent that you wanted to raise before you depart. Then all members who have questions can follow thereafter.
Chair, I think basically I won't be long about that. I might sound negative, but that was too much of a repetition since the implementation or the inception of the Batupile principle policy. I remember once again, I think I'll basically just be indicating that I think we as a state, as a developmental state, we need to start moving away from, it's fine, it's a presentation, it's giving us information, most probably useful to us as new members, I don't know. But the implementation, Chair, it's not there. The processes of implementation are not taking off. We are doing nothing about that. There's nothing going on in as far as implementation is concerned. And even if there was implementation, a special program, I remember, was executed, I think, from the Office of the Presidency, if I'm not mistaken, prior to the fourth parliament. And I think there was money spent on that, where you had people, I don't even, I must call them Batupile coordinators, moving out to provinces, reinstituting the Batupile principles simply because they were not effective in the public service and they were not properly implemented in the public service. That's why they came up with that we care, we belong, we serve, thinking that they are adding on to stressing the issue of the Batupile principles. But today and after this presentation, I get the feeling we're still at that point. Now, what I'd like to know from the department is what have they done or what do they have in terms of an, you are talking of an assessment strategy right now, but what has been happening before that to ensure that this works this time around? If this assessment implementation process is only going to be starting today with us listening to it. You know, so the feeling I'm getting out of this, we haven't moved. We haven't moved. Because if I had to go in detail now to ask certain questions out of this document, I might even take forever. But the bottom line is, in terms of the public service improving its status in terms of service delivery, we haven't moved and we're not hitting the nail on the head. I just like to leave it at that.
Yeah, thanks, Honourable Vikani. What is amplified is that we're expecting progress thereof. What are the good things? What are the stumbling blocks? How far have we gone? But it was like a reorientation into what is that feeling. And I really want to agree that at some point, you know, when we have presentation of this nature, it does benefit us as Parliament to know how best is the program working and what are the loopholes, what are the gaps, what is progress. Yeah, like she's actually indicating the way people, even in the past, were called transformation managers, how it was amplified. So I think we cannot reinvent the wheel. That is how it was presented. It was reorientation. Take it as group, but we expect to be developmental in terms of the approach and in terms of progress. So, honorable members, Honorable Mohale, Honorable Suka, Honorable Maluleke, and Honorable Kapanskauti.
Thank you, Chairperson.
is that Honorable Bikanias went out. I don't usually agree with her, but now I have to agree with her. I agree with her 100%. We are still at the beginning. I've heard that one of the things that you have done, you've distributed booklets about whatever number out there to people. But I'm from Limpopo, Hamujaji, a deep rural area. I've got my mother who cannot read or write. What does that booklet mean to her? Who's going to translate that book to her? Because she's at home now. In her own home, she cannot read or write. She'll just go out there, collect her mother, and they come and sit there. Who's going to say Batubele is this? She'll go to the clinic to collect her chronic medication. What if she's not treated well? Maybe she'll hear over the radio this Batubele. But what does that mean to her? Because really Batubele should mean not something to us who are in here, but something to those people who are sitting down there. Whatever, I cannot even translate this to those people out there, because they'll tell me, there's a hospital next to me. They say, I can't go to that hospital because it's a provincial hospital. I have to start at a district hospital. And the hospital is two kilometers from that person. That person can just walk into the hospital, but she can't use that hospital. Why is Batubele there? A 16-year-old cannot get her or his own ID at the Home Affairs office. Why is Batubele there, good people? You know, there are so many, Batubele is just not happening. Then you are saying that we should have a coordinator, that person who will implement whatever. If you take a person who has been working within the department, I've got 18 years working here, we've been doing things like this. Why do you think that person will change? What change is that person going to bring in the department? Not unless you take a person who's been there, down there, who knows the problems that they are encountering every day, the attitude that we get from a public servant, wherever, the attitude, I've been there, I've been working with them, I know how they treat our people. But here, really, nothing is happening. We are still at the beginning. People just hear about Batubele. Those clinics, wherever. The tuition service centers, you go to a tuition service center, they'll tell you, no, a Home Affairs, we've forgotten this form today, so we can't assist you. A person has traveled so many kilometers. A form is not there. But you tell me about Batubele. You say Limpopo is going to implement what is that courtesy. And I wonder if people will receive that courtesy. Because if today a DG, I need to call you honorable. No, I cannot. If I take you to Limpopo today, anywhere, in a township or wherever, and say, let's go to that department, they don't know you as a Home Affairs maybe. You'll stay there from 8 o'clock until 4:30. No assistance. But if they know it's the 18 DG, you'll be the first in the row, even though you find people there. No explanation. And thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable Mahali, thank you. Before I proceed to Honorable Suka, who's next, can I just request the members to just sum up, because we don't have time. It's already 1:58, and I know you also have to eat, Honorable Members. There is a session at 2 o'clock. Honorable
Sukh. I thought I was going to say quite a lot, but I could see the anger from that angle. Now, I'm just thinking in my mind whether to go for. Now, Chairperson, you see, there's a guy who was quite good in his propaganda, though I don't subscribe with his theory. Hopens, a propagandist, and he made the machinery of Germany work very well. And Hitler could overcome certain battles because of that. I think we are lacking that kind of specialist to talk about these issues continually, so that it is not faded in our minds, the intentions of the Batopile. We don't have that, because we launch it and we leave it to drive itself without being monitored by somebody. I think that's the first point that I wanted to raise. We need a good communicator about government programs in as far as this is concerned, because this is a continual thing. The reason why I'm raising this is because people are coming into the system, they move out, and you employ new people who have not been orientated properly in that. And secondly, we don't use the tools that we're having. Maybe we use them at a particular level. You see, our community radio stations, both the print and the electronic media, is there. But we talk very little, we use very little of those tools to popularize this thing. Because I remember when you were talking of service delivery, people would say the truck is coming of service delivery. Equally to Batopile, people think that it's something, you know, you can touch it. And people can't touch it, it's in the mind. I think we need to make use of that continuously, and our institutions of learning, be it higher or whatever, we should also look into that. I know at some in higher learning institutions, in their curriculum on the public management and other disciplines, they do have these principles. But to whom they imparting that knowledge is something else. So it goes back to our social background. So I'm saying we need to improve our communication strategy so that we are effective on that. The other issue is the question of the distance. I'm not sure whether you've defined the distance in terms of your own understanding. What distance does a person has to walk to access information or get assistance from government departments? Because if you take our provinces, their ruralness, take for example Eastern Cape, we inherited two homelands, the Ciskei and the Transkei. And those homelands, I'm telling you, they are quite vast, and the access from the deep ends of those rural to where these offices are, you wouldn't like to go. So I'm saying, so the radios and everything else will assist us one way to communicate our message on a continual basis. There was a program, you know, in Radio Club ONN. Normally it starts at 12. They call it 12 down. You see, people are listening to that thing. And as such, I think we must make use of that. My last point, Chair, before you say must stop. please, we will let it leave all others, but please translate your pamphlets. Because we've got 11 official languages so that people can read. And then let not take for granted everybody will understand English as a commercial language. Let us just stop there. Otherwise, I've got a lot to deal. Core issues, you know, that are fundamental to Batopile. Thank you.
Honourable members, we're proceeding to the last. Okay. We're coming to Honourable Maduleke. The last one will be Honourable Sansuka. No, we cannot. Can we proceed, Honourable Maduleke?
Then, they
yeah, they don't. I noticed that, yes. That is true. Okay, continue, Honourable Maduleke.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me not address this with that is a bit challenging. We are still having a big challenge on Batopile principles. If you want to hear the challenges, just use a taxi one day. You'll get the issues that people are raising in the taxis. One is that we have a big challenge in the Department of Health, particularly in our clinics. Where people are complaining about the attitude of the nurses. I'm going to address one in Klephart. The other issue is, yes, I'm going to address that. I'm going to go like everyone. They said I won't ask anything. I'll see by myself what is happening. and the person will confront me before I can talk to her. The other challenge is the issue of demarcations. You'll have the clinic next to the clinic next to the hospital. The hospital is called under Gauteng. The clinic is in Northwest. So the person will be traveling to the hospital in Northwest, which is maybe 100 kilometers, and the one next to him is 20 kilometers. So that is the other challenge of these demarcation issues, where we are saying what people principles we should bring service to next to the people. So it's the other challenge that we are having. The other one is the issue of imbizos. These imbizos, they provoke protest, because people, when they see the minister, the MEC, they have that impression that if they talk, something will happen tomorrow. And they will only come and ask, and with your information, that we're doing this tomorrow or next month. If that doesn't happen, they will say, minister was here. She says, or he says, this thing will happen tomorrow. That is the other challenge we are having, which we need to address it. If the minister is going to implement, he will have the research on the case where he or she is going to know what is happening there. If he has answers for those people, it must be the reality. These are one issues that have impact in the protest. Yes, I'm closing. I'm thinking this change management, maybe it will address some issues. If you can do this training, go and research how is it particularly working for the people, because now it's quite not working. Partly some are, and this issue of overload for public servants. This overload, it makes also them to be stressed, and they take their stress to other people. So also this part must be re-looked at it. Thank you.
Yes, another one is fun,
Calvary.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be very short. You know, a question I asked the minister on the Palama and the training of the 8 Batopele principles. He indicated to me that there is a 2 to 3 day compulsory course for public service entrance where the Batopele principles are also addressed. Now, my question, Mrs. Clark, is it only the theoretical knowledge of Batopele principles, or do those public, the new public entrants, do they have a sort of a practical situation where they do in-service training or role play, as far as especially the attitudes concerned, in a certain situation? How must I address the public according to this and that part of their principles? The practical part of the training, I think, is very important. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Honourable Fans. The department will know that there's no time at all to respond, which we are therefore going to request most of the responses can be done in writing. But if there's anything pending in less than 3 minutes, just to take the pending one, but please the rest of them, please if they can be put in writing so that we can do the announcement, which are very critical as well.
Yeah. No, I think in the last part of the presentation, in terms of the impact assessment, the issues that were raised as concern by the honourable members is absolutely noted, and hence the impact assessment strategy is trying to address that. And also with the introduction of the Ministry for Performance Monitoring and Evaluation, they have taken cognizance of exactly what the concerns are of the honourable members, and hence you would see that in the last part of the outcomes-based issues that have to be measured and put in place is responding directly to the President's words, where he wants to see Batopele as a living campaign. and hence that is the challenge that has been placed at our door. And just as a matter of note, the books have been translated to all 11 languages and they are available, and we can give those, because that is one of the principles. Thanks.
Honourable members, thank you, and my apologies for putting you under tight pressure. You noticed it was time and the department as well. Thank you, and of course, we will expect some other things for you to detail them down in writing so that we are much clearer. We will still want to engage you in matters of this nature. Perhaps after we got the responses and we know exactly, perhaps we'll outline what is it that we really want from our side as well, so that we don't get the briefing of what we are very well versed with, but you therefore get progression thereof. Members, I need to indicate to you that you will have noticed even the change of program for 2 o'clock, where we are supposed to be in the meeting quite last for the money bill. Many things have actually changed. We know that for our program, while the department is still here, we actually resorted to having a workshop, one-on-one, members together with the department in terms of going through our program, which our oversight program as we have aligned, you know, because most of the time it looks like we, you know, you remember in the workshop we never had time to actually engage with the department, but we're looking into our role of oversight. So perhaps we wanted some space to engage the department there so they understand and know which direction we're taking, so that moving forward they know exactly where we're moving, and we don't find, you know, one another wanting, but we sort of come together quite well. Also, with a program where we need the minister, we actually make sure that the minister is part of the program and that we can be able to do in a workshop. When we look at the day we planned, it's next Wednesday, and we'll get an indication from the department if the minister can be available. And we note that it might be complicated. We'd like to work around on a time where the minister can be available. So if we can get an indicator so that we plan appropriately, perhaps also from the side of the Parliament, the Secretariat, where we get the time where we can all be available to work, and members be informed on time, and even SMS, because now it's not scheduled, they might miss it if we depend particularly on the pigeonhole. Again, members, the report for Tucson centers, as we did the oversight, are finalized in the pigeon hole. We do have recommendations as well as per our request. You can get them, they are available. We will go through administrative areas of minutes so that we don't have a huge load that is a bedlock. When we come to other meetings, we won't manage in terms of these meetings because we're under pressure. But moving forward, we have engaged with the Chair of Parliament this morning, and they have started to appreciate the nature and the scope of work that the Public Safety and Administration Committee has. And therefore, Parliament, when we go to, will be looking broadly into our program and into our scope of work, including the capacity that is required and the pulling of other committees together. And so far, I think there's consensus in terms of the clear understanding of governance, the critical of oversight also on governance, the same as we do with the Auditor General's report, the outcomes that are brought to Parliament, including the other document like annual programs. I'd like to thank everyone for being part of this meeting, and we're looking forward to ensuring that our annual programs are implemented appropriately. Thanks.
Can I just ask you, why are the overall questions for the governance subject in your talk?
I wasn't aware that we were drawn. We'll just check. So we'll just check because we don't know that we've actually submitted it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just have one or two questions to raise. The measures you are considering corruption.
Yes.
Yes, tiny ones, trying to see.
Lovely.